underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Anarchy on the airway.
The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who replaced him, cooperating with the president.
And you have it tuned to your source, 89.1 WIDR. This is the People's Power Hour. With us, we have a guest, Dale Allen Pfeiffer. Dale, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Dale is a novelist, a science journalist, a geologist, and a radical activist. His latest novel, Giants and Their Steps, a cautionary tale of the apparent duality between modern civilization and nature, is available from his publisher, www.lulu.com, or through amazon.com. He has traveled extensively through the U.S. and Canada by car, train, thumb, and bicycle. He is considered by many to be an authority on energy, resource depletion, and related geopolitical issues. So, Dale, thanks for having you on today.
Thank you for having me.
Good. Glad to have you. We'd like to begin with a couple definitions on some of your essays and your books. You talk about the phrases peak oil and natural gas cliff. What exactly do you mean by those?
Okay, well, let's tackle the peak oil first. By peak oil, what I mean is the peak of the oil production profile. If you drew out a profile of oil production from a particular well or field, it would start out at the bottom, rise up to a peak, and then after the peak, it would diminish. They all follow that pattern. Sort of like a bell curve. And we talk about peak oil because when you reach the peak of oil production, you can't produce any more than that. You are at the maximum. After that, you are inevitably going to decline. Every oil field follows that profile. There have been no deviations.
So you don't think with more money and more exploration that we're going to find significant sources and reserves of oil?
No, we have a pretty good idea of where the oil is and where it isn't. As a matter of fact, most of the technological innovations over the last 30 years or so have gone to show us where oil isn't. We know the sort of rock that hosts it. We know pretty much how it is formed, and so far as the technological innovations in drilling and extraction, they raise the extraction rate a little bit, but they don't really prolong the fields. As a matter of fact, many of them make the downward side of the production profile even sharper than it would be normally.
So we'd really need to find significant sources of oil to slow down or to prolong that peak.
We would have to, yes. We would have to, by some calculations, by certain mathematical models, we would have to find five more North Sea fields and bring them online before the peak in order to make any difference. And that would only delay the peak by a year or two. And by the way, most predictions now are looking at the peak occurring within the next year or two. So, you know, are we going to discover 5 to 6 new North Sea equivalent fields and bring them online in that time? It's pretty much impossible.
No way. That's just not going to happen.
No.
And, okay, your latest novel, which is a novel, Giants and Their Steps, you talk about the duality between civilization and us sustaining ourselves on nature. Do you fit the peak oil ideas into that novel, too?
I don't actually talk about peak oil in that novel. That book takes place well into the future at a point where civilization is on the verge of collapse due to resource depletion, and the characters in the novel are struggling along through it.
Well, I don't know how far in the future that is, but where do you see us, let's say, in 50 years from now? I know it's hard to speculate. Nobody can say. There's so many variables. But what do you think 50 years from now?
Yeah, I would have to start out with the caveat that a lot could happen to change any sort of prediction of where we could be in 50 years. I mean, you know, 20 years from now, we could discover a cheap and simple source of fusion and solve our energy problems. It's unlikely because every time that I look at what's going on with fusion, they're saying, well, it's about 20 years down the road. They were saying that back in the 70s. They said that in the 80s. They said that in the 90s, and they're saying that right now. It's not likely to happen soon, but something could always happen. There could always be some sort of change.
Yeah, we seem to be getting a lot of that from our other guests and some other authors lately, too, dispelling the myth of this miracle energy source, or the fact that hydrogen fuel cells are going to solve all of our energy problems in the next few years. There seems to be consensus now that that's more of a kind of a placate to not alarm people that, you know, our energy sources that we use are really running out.
Yes, that's pretty much the consensus among those who have studied the alternatives. In 50 years' time, well, we are not going to have much oil left. By the year 2030, latest projections show that coal within the United States will have peaked as well, even though we have a lot of it in the ground. The economy is going to look pretty bad unless we make some significant changes in the way we live.
I'll be doing a lot more bike riding than I am already, at that time. And obviously the economy is already awful in Michigan right now, too, for any normal person to find a job and find a living wage, too. So that's bad news.
Yes, and I'm afraid it doesn't look much better. When you're talking about having less energy in the system year to year, how can you expect to make any sort of progress to continue growth, you know?
Dale, I was also wondering if you could explain for our listeners this phrase, natural gas cliff. Here in the Midwest, of course, we're very dependent on natural gas for heating, amongst other things, and I was just wondering if you could explain that for us.
Yes, let's come back to that. First, I should mention a few things about oil and the nature of oil. Oil is a liquid. It's a very thick liquid, somewhat like molasses. It moves through the ground very slowly. When you drill a well and start pumping, you get what's right around the well and held under pressure. That comes up easily. After that, you have to start drawing the oil to the wellhead, and eventually you wind up using more energy to draw the oil out than you will get out of the oil. At that point, the well is capped and they don't produce it anymore. Natural gas is different because it's a gas. And because of the nature of gases, as soon as you drill that well, you've invested all the energy you need to produce from that well. After that, the gas comes rushing out. But the profile, you know, it'll show a rise up to a peak, and then there's generally sort of a plateau. And somewhere along that plateau, production just drops off quickly. They call it the cliff because it's much sharper than the drop in production from an oil field. And in North America, all three countries here, Mexico, the United States, and very recently Canada, have all peaked in natural gas production and are balanced right on the edge of that natural gas cliff. The only thing that's picked it up, that's kept it going so far, is we continue bringing new wells online, but they deplete a lot faster than the bigger wells did. So we're just barely treading water in that direction. And very soon, we're going to fall off that cliff.
Okay. I was also interested to learn from some of the articles you wrote about how a clause was inserted into the North American Free Trade Agreement about Canada's natural gas supplies.
Yes. we rigged that treaty very well in the favor of the U.S. The U.S. has the right to purchase natural gas from Canada before the Canadians can even use it themselves.
What about this issue of liquefied natural gas and liquefied natural gas terminals and tankers we hear discussed a lot recently?
Yeah, well, they're going to build some, but for one thing, the amount of energy that you will get out of liquefied natural gas is lower. It has to be because you have to put in energy into liquefying the natural gas, that is, chilling it down to the liquid state. And then you have to put all the energy into transport and then into transforming it back into the gas state, besides which you have to build huge refrigerated cargo vessels and special offloading facilities to offload the liquefied natural gas and return it to the gas state. Very expensive. It's not going to be an answer. It will help a little bit, but it won't make up for everything we will lose in North America. That's why with oil, you look at the entire world, the entire world oil picture. But with natural gas, you have to look at regions because for all intents and purposes, the natural gas you're going to use is the natural gas that can be piped to you.
I see. I was also very interested in a two-part article you wrote for FromTheWilderness.com comparing how two different states, Cuba and North Korea, respectively, dealt with massive energy shortages. Could you tell us a little bit about each of these cases and what are the implications for the rest of the world that you see from this research that you've done?
Yeah, I should back up a moment from those articles and mention the article I wrote previous to them, Eating Fossil Fuels.
Okay.
In that article, I examined the impact of energy depletion on food production. Basically, in this country, for each calorie of food we consume, it requires 10 calories of fossil fuels to produce that one calorie of food. That is, most of our fertilizer, well, all of our fertilizer, really, is manufactured from natural gas. And the pesticides we put on our monocrops are manufactured from oil. We use oil and natural gas to drive the machinery, which tills the field, plants the crops, harvests the crops, brings the water up from the aquifers and spreads it on the fields, that ships the crops to wherever they are processed. The energy that goes into processing them, the energy that goes into shipping them from where they've been processed to the supermarkets where we purchase them, that 10 calories of fossil fuels per one calorie of food doesn't even bring into account the amount of energy we use driving to the grocery store to pick them up or the amount of energy we use at home cooking them. When you look at that and examine it in light of peak oil and energy depletion, what you see very quickly is that we are approaching an agricultural crisis. So after I wrote that article, I looked around and said, now where have they suffered massive energy shortages and how have they reacted to it? And the two examples that came to mind first were North Korea and Cuba, both of which lost their energy base when the Soviet Union collapsed. Neither country produces very much natural gas or oil. In the case of North Korea, it's a very bleak picture. They basically starved to death. You had people actually going out and eating the bark off of trees just to survive.
Wow.
You had field machinery laying around rusting in the field because there was no oil to run it and no way to even get anybody out to repair it when it broke down. massive crop failures. The picture was complicated by flooding and the destruction of some hydroelectric projects. But largely it was all the result of energy depletion. There was massive starvation in North Korea, which was barely whispered in this country. Didn't talk about it much. Cuba is a different story, largely because of the way they handled it. In Cuba, there was already a program in the universities looking at organic agriculture and various other ways of doing things agriculturally. When their crisis occurred, at first their caloric intake dipped drastically, but then they kind of rallied to the emergency. The universities basically opened up all their research and made it available to the population. They switched to organic agriculture, and people began developing their own gardens. They developed community gardens in rural areas, in urban areas. And they were able to raise their caloric intake to just about the normal daily requirement. It still falls a little short, but it's close. It's much, much closer than North Korea. They did this through a lot of community effort, solidarity, and a lot of things that we don't have in abundance here in the U.S. anymore.
And you have to wonder, too, if the quality of those calories, it being locally produced organic agriculture, is somehow maybe affecting the health of the population in a little bit more positive way than all the calories we consume.
Yes, yes. Very true.
So they were able to deal with their crisis so much. They had a pretty major energy crisis in Cuba there, and they were able to deal with it somewhat?
Yes, to the point that they have actually started to export some of their experts to other countries, and mainly in South America and the Caribbean, to teach them the various things that they've learned about organic agriculture and farming cooperatives, that sort of thing.
Well, we've got a community garden program here in Kalamazoo. Maybe we should take a field trip down to Cuba one of these days, and they can teach us a few things, although I don't see that happening anytime soon. So in a place like Cuba, obviously their energy uses, their energy needs are much less and much less intensive than they are here in the United States. What's going to happen when we have a big energy crisis here?
Well, in the first place, it's kind of a misnomer to call it to talk about an energy crisis, because it's not going to be something that happens suddenly. You know, we're not going to wake up tomorrow and discover there's no oil.
Right.
We're talking about a depending on which model you look at, a 2 to 5, and some of the more drastic models as much as 7 or 10% decrease per year, but most of the models show about a 2% decrease in year per year in the amount of oil produced, which would mean that by 2020 the world would be producing as much oil as it produced in 1990. The agricultural problems will be farther down the road, and studies mainly by Dr. David Pimentel show that the population of the United States, in order to be supported by organic, non-hydrocarbon agriculture, needs to decline by one-third, which is a pretty large segment of the population. But getting back to the rate of decline, it is going to be relatively small. The way it's going to hit us is, first, economically. That is going to be the first major impact of oil depletion.
So it sounds like it's just going to be a not a quick death, but a slow, painful process. And again, here we're talking to Dale Allen Pfeiffer. He's a novelist, a science journalist, a geologist, and a radical activist. And he's got a new novel out called Giants in Their Steps, cautionary tale of the apparent duality between modern civilization and nature. And we're here talking to Dale today on 89.1 WIDR, the People's Power Hour.
Dale, I had another question for you. You've also written quite a bit about the relationship between peak oil and climate change. And I was just wondering if you could discuss that a little bit for us.
Yeah. A lot of people look at the problem of peak oil and they say, well, this will be great for climate change. You know, we won't have to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you look into it with a little more depth, what you see, especially, unfortunately, in the U.S. and China, is a move being made towards coal, because we have abundant coal resources. Once you realize that there's a move being made toward coal, then you realize that it isn't a good thing for climate change. I've been doing research lately about global dimming, which is kind of the flip side of the climate change coin. Over the last couple decades, they have noticed that the albedo, which is the amount of sunlight reflected from the surface of the Earth, is actually rising. And they haven't been able to figure out what is causing it. They are narrowing in on it, and it looks like what is causing it is particulates in the air, particulate pollution. That is not the carbon dioxide, but the small particles in the smog that circulate in the atmosphere and reflect the sunlight or block it from reaching the surface. This has canceled out some of the warming which should have occurred through global warming. Coal production produces, or coal burning produces, a lot of particulates, and the worry is that as we turn back to coal, we will require coal burning plants to sequester carbon so that they won't be putting as much carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide into the atmosphere as they would have done. However, nobody's talking about doing anything about particulates, so they'll continue putting the particulates up. It will moderate the effect of global warming to an extent, but then, say, 20, 30 or so, when coal peaks and coal burning begins to decline, it takes less time for particulates to rain out of the atmosphere than it does for carbon dioxide. So eventually the particulates will rain out, the carbon dioxide will still be there and will suddenly be hit by twice the impact of global warming that we currently have.
It could potentially get really warm really quick, and it sounds sort of like a double whammy too. You know, we've got some global warming stuff coming on, yet at the same time we're not getting as much sunlight reaching Earth, which is going to reduce the ability of all the plants on the Earth to produce energy too.
Yes, there is that potential. Some of the studies show that it's not that much of an effect on plants, although it does stress them a bit and makes them more liable to diseases and that sort of thing, which is bad, especially in the case of our monocrop.
Yeah, and we all know the only source of energy in the whole Earth does come from, you know, sunlight basically here too. So, you know, any chance of cutting down on that would be bad news for all kinds of things on our planet too.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, you also mentioned the effect of these particulates and vapor trails and things like that on global weather patterns. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yes. I have talked to, I cannot think of his name right now. If he's listening, he will be upset I cannot remember his name. The professor at the University of Wisconsin, who has been doing the research on contrails, and he was able to gather data from all over the United States in the 3 days following 9/11, when air traffic was banned.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to analyze this data, and he didn't actually look at the change in temperature. What he looked at was the range of temperature over the day, because the change in temperature is very unstable. You know, I mean, look at us right now. Last week we were in the 80s, and now, you know, last weekend we had snow.
Right.
But anyways, he looked at the difference between the daily high and the daily low. And for the 3 days that air traffic was banned, he found that daily temperatures were climbing, which means that because there were fewer contrails in the air, more sunlight was reaching the Earth's surface.
Dale, this is also 2005 is the 100-year anniversary of the IWW. You mentioned in your bio that you've been a long-time member of the industrial workers of the world, and I was just wondering how your analysis of the capitalist system fits into your analysis of all these environmental and resource issues we've been discussing.
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I do have an article. Actually, it's titled A Call for Action. You can find it on the survivingpeakoil.com website, and you can also find it on the fromthewilderness.com website. I discussed that quite a bit. There have been some people who have disagreed with me, but I still believe that our problems can be traced back to capitalism, the way we have exploited this planet. Capitalism thrives because of constant growth. The economy has to continuously grow. And you can't grow something without energy. It's as simple as that.
Interesting. I believe you actually wrote, I think it was in that piece, that capitalism is antithetical to democracy. And that just very much reminded me of the ideology that was held by the labor movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that we've kind of lost over the years, it seems.
Yeah, well, you know, in capitalism, you have a capitalist class, you know, those who control the means of production, and then you have workers who basically just live off of what they can make with their labor, what they are paid by the capitalist class, and that sounds pretty antithetical to democracy, if you ask me.
Okay. I think that's kind of interesting, because the way you discussed how this resource depletion scenario might play out in the United States is not happening in one dramatic moment, but happening slowly over time. It would seem to me, I don't know if this is your position, but that the ruling class might try to keep the workers, the lower classes, thinking about other issues and not noticing this slow depletion of energy and this drop in living standards.
Oh, yes. And at the same time, you know, move in to limit liberties so that when there is massive public unrest, it can be dealt with. You know, that's what we see with the Patriot Act and with a lot of legislation that has come down the pike in the last few years.
All right, Dale, thanks for being on today. I think we're going to wrap things up here. Are you a native of Holly? Is that right, Holly, Michigan?
Oh, that's where we reside at the moment.
Okay. I live quite a few years in Clarkston, just up the road.
Oh,
so.
Okay, that's where I was originally from.
Yeah, it's crazy. Radical people popping up all over the place on Michigan. So, anyways, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Great, and maybe we'll have you back on again sometime.